You are listening to The Lex Valdez Show. Hello and welcome to The Lex Valdez Show, the podcast that attempts to understand the zeitgeist influencing life in the Indian subcontinent, whether it be through history, politics, or even the more philosophical aspects of pop culture. I am your host, Bharat Joshi. On February 8, 2017, Prime Minister Narendra Modi made a remark in Parliament against his predecessor Dr. Manmohan Singh, stating that, quote, "So many scams, yet his career is spotless. Dr. Sahib knows the art of taking a bath with a raincoat on," end quote. Supporters cheered, opponents fumed, and liberals like myself merely shook their heads. Even given the very, very low bar for the standard of political debate in India, this statement struck me as particularly ironic. Think about it. This much-applauded jibe came from a man who, until very recently, was being tried for his suspected role in the deaths of women and children. To go from being murder suspect to being hailed as one of the most progressive leaders the world has ever seen. Talk about raincoats. There is no denying the fact that the last few years of the UPA were embarrassing, to say the least. And to be fair, the shadows of scams loom very large over Dr. Singh's legacy. But how objective is that? In fact, how objective are we as a nation about any of our leaders? Join me, Bharat Joshi, and my good friend Sandeep Bhardwaj, as we try to understand India's most influential prime ministers. Get comfy, folks. This is a long one. Sandy, welcome to the show. All right, before we start things off, I'd just like to, for the sake of people listening and who do not know you, just explain very shortly what it is like to do.
I work at Center for Policy Research. I essentially work on Indian history. So right. Post-independence history, political, diplomatic, stuff like that. And I have studied at University of Chicago. Before that, I was an engineer like everybody else in this country. I have worked in newspaper. I have worked in television channel. I have worked in all sorts of places, political parties, etc., etc. But what I primarily work on is within the think tank community. I work on Indian history.
Right. So is it fair to call you a career academic at this point?
I'm semi-academic, let's call
me. Semi-academic, very, very modest of you. Because that's not true. I think you are a career academic. I think people will find that out soon enough. Right, so it's interesting, the way we met is, about 2-3 years ago now?
Yeah.
Over a casual dinner at a friend's place.
Yeah.
And I can honestly say that you are the only historian that I know, personally at least.
Yeah.
So the conversations we've had have been interesting, and I've been told by more than a few people that we should have recorded some of the ones that we've had.
Yeah.
So this is us doing exactly that, so let's get into it.
Yeah, great.
We're not going to talk about Trump.
Yeah.
Right? We're just not going to do that.
Yeah.
As much as the subject might be tempting, I think it's kind of overdone and sort of unnecessary at this point. So let's instead bring the conversation closer to home and talk about the most influential prime ministers that India has had.
Hmm.
And we'll work our way chronologically backwards, so starting from the most recent one. And we should probably mention what we mean by influential. We don't mean good, we don't mean bad, but we do mean
people who had impact.
An impact, whether it be for good or ill.
Yeah.
Take it away then.
No, so that is in itself a controversial question, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like all the prime ministers have their people who believe that these guys were gods or these people were evil. And especially with a country like India, where our sense of history is not too strong and there are way too many myths attached to almost everybody, right? It becomes extremely problematic to make a kind of argument about who was good and who was bad, especially also because our definition of what is good and bad keeps changing.
It's subjective.
Yes. The people who in 70s, more or less everybody, there was a greater agreement on the idea that if you are moving towards socialism, then that's good.
Mm.
But today, anybody moves towards socialism is bad, seen as bad, right? So our definition also changes in those kind of regards. So when we talk about the impact thing, let's just first get out of the way the prime ministers who were there for too short a time,
right,
and had too unstable a government to really make any kind of impact, right?
Okay.
So we have, say for example, Morarji Desai, we have Charan Singh, we have Chandrasekhar, Devegowda, H.D. Devegowda, and I.K. Gujral,
right,
who we can exclude right off the bat. And I would also say, and this might be controversial now, which is that I would say Lal Bahadur Shastri also really doesn't make that much an impact.
Oh man, a guy that's so romanticized. You don't like him. We'll get into that in a bit, I suppose.
So, yeah.
How long was he in for? I don't even remember.
18 months.
18
not
months.
More than that, right? Like
18 months seems to be a running trend with these guys, right? The guys who didn't last for a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a few months. And Lal Bahadur Shastri, while he oversees 1965 war and... even before that, there are changes that he tries to bring in. They're interesting stuff. So, for example, I think the Indian arms deal with Soviets is signed during his period.
Mm.
And a lot of other stuff is done. But it is essentially, he is essentially continuing Nehru's policy.
Is it fair to say that the reason, part of the reason why he's so romanticized is because there is this belief, whether it be true or not, that had it not been for him, China would have just run over us.
No, he wasn't prime minister during the...
But the arms didn't happen during his time, right?
No, that's 1964. That's afterwards, right? That's a different issue altogether.
I'm talking post-war. Because there were fears at the time that China could repeat what they did.
He hasn't been credited with like keeping India safe against China or something.
Then why
like
the romanticism? Because I've never understood
that. The romanticism comes from politics, right? The idea that for the first 30 years of Indian history, you really don't have any non-Nehru Gandhi family prime minister. So that's why when you want to do an anti-Congress argument of any kind, especially with today's environment of vilification of Nehru and everybody else, right?
Which we'll get into.
So... what do you do? You really don't have any prime ministers to argue it for. So what you do is you do a counterfactual argument. So that's why Patel could have been a great prime minister. That's an argument constantly put in, even though we haven't seen Patel as a prime minister ever. So
right.
We don't know, right?
Right.
Same way Lal Bahadur Shastri is one non-Nehru Gandhi prime minister that you have from the era.
Mm-hmm.
So you make a hero out of him because you can basically appropriate him, right? Because... that's Congress's fault itself. Congress basically disassociates themselves from pretty much any non-Nehru Gandhi prime minister that they have had.
Right.
Right? So
right.
That's why Narasimha Rao, who was a Congress prime minister, or even Lal Bahadur Shastri, who was a Congress prime minister, these guys are not really celebrated the same way as Indira Gandhi or Rajiv Gandhi is within the Congress circles.
True.
Which allows other political parties to appropriate them.
Mm.
Right?
Okay, fair enough. All right, moving on. These are the guys who do not matter.
I would argue these are the guys who had very limited
right.
Impact on course of Indian history, right?
Right.
So the others.
Mm. The ones that actually do matter now.
Yeah,
right.
The ones that do matter. So we want to do it chronologically backwards?
Yeah, because I think it makes sense. It's much more relatable to talk about Manmohan Singh, for example, than Nehru.
Yeah, in modern terms.
For us at least,
yeah.
People who are still alive and know
yeah.
What happened.
So let's start with Manmohan Singh. So Manmohan Singh is certainly, I would say, one of the best prime ministers that we have had.
Yeah, we've had some heated discussions about this.
Yeah, it's
but you make a good point, though. I have always been under the opinion that he was an excellent finance minister, prime minister not so much. And to this day, it's hard for me to shake this feeling that he's the kind of guy you want to be. You want him as a right-hand man. You don't want him at the helm of affairs. Because he just doesn't come across as a, and I hate this term, quote-unquote, strong leader.
Yeah.
So, which I think might be symptomatic of a problem that's maybe unique to any sort of populist system, democracy or otherwise. You just need these guys that look charismatic even if they're not. Modi being a prime example.
Yeah.
And so I think he fails that test. In terms of intellect, it's hard to argue with his credentials. In terms of the impact he had as a finance minister, again, very hard to argue. As a prime minister, though, you're going to have to convince me. So go ahead.
So there are a couple of things, right? Like, one is, do we really need a strong character, like strong man prime minister, as you suggest kind of thing, right? Because...
Oh, I'm not saying that we need it. I'm just saying that's the perceived notion.
Yeah, that he was weak, right? Yeah. But there is a stable government for 10 years, which is more than most other prime ministers that we have had in India.
Yeah, you can't see this right now, but stable is in air quotes.
No, but there is a stable government in terms of it doesn't collapse, right? That is essentially stable government. And there is stability within cabinet as well. It's not like the ministers are being fired left and right and center and there are no parties running away and coming back and all that. Coalition is more or less stable, right?
Mm.
And so in terms of the argument that, yes, he was not the kind of Indira Gandhi kind of strong prime minister who could just do whatever he wanted kind of thing. But that's not a bad thing. In democracy with checks and balances, sometimes it's good not to have a prime minister who is so strong that he can do whatever he wants.
Right.
Other than that...
Excuse me, I'm going to interrupt for a second here. Is that not a problem within the Indian system? There is an argument to be made that you need someone who can do precisely that. That is to say... this is the law, this is what I say, and we must do this now because this bickering is not working anymore.
So there are arguments to be made for both directions, right? I mean, the guys who will just steamroll over everybody and then just get stuff done the way they want to.
Which is very much
done, right?
Like a pro-Trump argument in a way.
Yeah.
Right?
And so that's the argument which is popular these days. I mean, when Modi was getting elected in India, that was the kind of argument that you were talking about. That guy.
Okay, never mind.
Yeah. We want a Singapore-style leadership and all that stuff.
Of course we do.
Right?
We do, yeah.
So, but as the people who do not support Modi or Trump... would argue that, you know, I mean, it's actually better if you have a kind of leader who tries to get everybody along. If things are patchy, that's also okay and stuff like that. But let's get back to the impact of Manmohan Singh, which is where the important stuff, which is overlooked probably because we are so close to the era, and especially because we went through this whole scam-ridden environment that we went through in the last...
Yeah.
Say 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, the art movement didn't help.
Right.
Did it.
But historically, I don't think the scam feeling, the feeling that we had of India being extra corrupt and all that stuff, historically it won't matter so much. What will matter is the lasting legacy of the 10 years, right?
Right.
And that's why, if you remember, before Manmohan Singh was going out, he gave this press conference and he said, somebody asked him about his legacy and he said that very confidently that history will judge me on my legacy, right?
That's a very Manmohan Singh thing to say.
Yeah,
too.
But that I think is because he was fairly confident of that. Legacy-wise, I think there are greater impact that Manmohan Singh has left.
Right.
Then most prime ministers, I would argue, top three certainly, right? And here is why. One, you have a continuous non-stop GDP growth, right? Economic growth.
Mm.
You also have a growth of standards of living of people, right?
Which both of which were kind of initiated by him as finance minister, you could argue, right?
Yeah, they were initiated by him during liberalization, but after liberalization, we tend to forget that liberalization also went through ups and downs.
Sure.
And there were plenty of ways that it could have gone wrong, right? Liberalization doesn't mean that there's a guarantee that things will go fine.
Of course.
Right? So to make that thing keep going on for 10 years without any major stumble of any kind.
In a system like ours, that too.
That is exceptionally impressive.
Fair point.
Some number two, the second most important economic crisis in the last 100 years, which is the 2008 depression, right? Recession. You managed to handle it with tremendous amount of stability and grace and all sorts of things, right? There are only a couple of countries, China and India, who are managed to...
weather the storm quite
weathers the storm.
Yeah.
And in that too, China does it with a massive bailout, right? Which India doesn't have to.
Mm.
And there you have the kind of management which comes with tremendous amount of... intellectual firepower within the cabinet and experience, right? And that's because we don't know today what are the decisions being made.
Mm.
What were the decisions being made during 2008, the crisis era? But I cannot imagine that every day there must have been several questions in front of Prime Minister in terms of oil prices are going up, this thing changing, copper prices are this, that, all sorts of things. And how do we handle it, right? And all those things. So it is not just the inherent stability of Indian economic structure which kept us going,
right?
There were some very...
decisions that were made by someone.
Very artful management done there, right? Mm-hmm. So that's where another place where...
So what do you say to this idea?
Let me finish it quickly. So other than that, the one major thing, 10 years, you have no major conflict of any kind.
Yeah, that is surprising. We forget that, don't we?
Right. Yeah. So you don't get into trouble with Pakistan. You don't get into trouble with all sorts of things. At the same time, you do nuclear deal, you enhance the international standing of India to a whole other level.
Mm.
And I'll give you another example, which is that internal insurgency are brought under control. So Northeast, a lot of things are finally quite, like, ceasefires are done with a lot of people. And Naxals, which was considered in mid-2000s to be the biggest growing problem that India had, the whole thing is rolled back. We forget, but Naxals were actually gaining in, when these guys came into power.
Mm.
Naxals were actually gaining ground in India. And the whole thing is rolled back, and now they are on the back foot.
Right.
And that thing is done under Manmohan Singh. So he actually fought a war, a secret war.
Right?
Which we don't know about.
Mm.
Yeah.
Which is kind of surprising to me. You would think that they would be trumpeting this fact from the rafters and the rooftops of every building. And
because it's politically problematic, right? You don't want to come off as extremely anti-Naxal as well. You want to do it quietly. Because there are voters out there as well.
Fair point again. Yeah, I just... this is not a fair statement to make, but there is this feeling, especially within the people who support Modi, that within his tenure, and I mean Manmohan Singh's tenure, India became perceived as what could best be termed as a soft target.
Hmm.
Because we didn't do much, whatever that means.
Yeah.
Why do you think that narrative persists?
I think that's a very complicated question, and you know, it's gonna take a long time.
Right, so we'll table that, but it is an unfair thing to say, in your opinion. Yeah.
That under Manmohan Singh we were soft target?
Yeah.
I would say it's a fairly unfair thing.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. So we have discussed Manmohan Singh and his impact. What's next?
Before that, we come to Vajpayee, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, before Manmohan Singh, Vajpayee is the interesting character. And so the Vajpayee, historical legacy of Vajpayee to the greatest extent, more than nuclear explosion and the Kargil war and all that stuff, is essentially the idea that this was the first time that Hindu right wing actually came to power. And they could have done so much more in terms of moving India towards the Hindu right wing direction. And I think he, in some ways, acted as a cork on that.
Yeah, see, I'm not sure I'm convinced with that. Because, and there's no way that we can test this because we can't go back in time and see what happens. But to me, it seems like the only reason he acted, as you say, a cork on a flood sort of situation is because he just didn't get the time.
There seems to be a certain understanding between BJP and RSS during during the first NDA government that, you know, that the first term, let us do the economy and all that, BJP guys are saying, and you do the Hindutva stuff afterwards when the second time we come to power kind of thing. So there's certainly, it seems like there was this understanding. So RSS did keep in check. But you have to remember, I mean, this is 90s when these guys come to power, right? Early 90s, our 90s begin, India's 90s, with tremendous amount of communal strife.
Upheaval, and you have
Bawdi Masjid and all that. At that time, the right wing is extremely radical in this country.
Mm.
And they are moving towards a kind of vision for India, which is pretty...
horrific, really.
No, not... I mean, if we don't do the value judgment, pretty radical, right?
Okay, right.
The Hindutva movement is supposed to be far more extreme and radical than what we actually get when they come into power.
Right. See, this is what I like about you. You have this idea of being able to somehow remove yourself from the emotion of the thing and just say it like a rational human being, which is kind of sometimes hard for me to do. Because I said horrific and you said, let's just forget the value judgment. Like, how the hell do you forget the value judgment? That's the whole point of this conversation, but it's not. So, fair enough. But the thing is, it's hard for me to see him as any sort of stopgap measure or whatever you want to call it, because it was under his tenure. Was it Murali Manohar Joshi was the education minister, I want to say?
Yeah, I think so.
And he's the one who really began this idea of rewriting history books. The second you do that, I don't care, man.
Rewriting history books has been going on for, like, since time immemorial. No, the guys in the left during Indira Gandhi, all that, they did all these shady stuff as well, right?
Okay.
It's a fairly old pastime of political players, right? And the question is, to what degree do you do it kind of stuff? see, Modi comes to power and immediately you have all the stuff going on of that Dalit kid who dies Andhra Pradesh.
The church things.
Yeah, you have, we have all this stuff. And you have this RSS moving into several organizations and all sorts of stuff like that. This kind of creeping Hindutva that is happening today, right? That didn't happen during Vajpayee stuff. Which is not to say that nothing happened during Vajpayee stuff. Obviously, there was some Hindutva agenda. But I would say that in 2014 when Modi came, India had far less appetite for communal stuff than they did in 90s.
Yeah, that was a bad
and
time.
Had you had a different kind of prime minister, the one who was all on board with Hindutva thing, you could have really done the kind of stuff back then, which you can't do now.
Right.
That, I think, essentially would be the most important legacy of Vajpayee.
Damage control, really. Yeah, that's
not damage control, as in not just damage control, it's worse than that. It's he could have done so much worse than what he ended up doing. So other than that, we can talk about his foreign policy and all that stuff, but it didn't really leave lasting impact. So I mean, for example, nuclear thing, we were already fiddling with nuclear weapons, right? Like, he tested the nuclear weapons, but we had nuclear weapons before he came to power. And everybody kind of knew about it. We just didn't publicly say. And he continued with the economic policy, which was basically laid out. He elaborated a little bit on it. In other aspects, I don't see something radically different. So that's why we can skip all of that.
Right. See, here's what I remember from his tenure. This phrase, ye achhi baat nahi hai. And kabutas flying in the background. That's pretty much it. All right, moving on. Who's next?
So, I think before that, we have Devegowda and I.K. Gujral and their inconsequential premiership. But before that, we get to Narasimha Rao.
Narasimha Rao, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's an interesting guy.
Historically, work hasn't been done so much on him. So, we still know very little about all the stuff that happened. But there are two obvious things which stand out from Narasimha Rao period. One is that you did economic liberalization and you did it in a way which didn't get you into a lot of trouble, right?
Mm.
I mean, you can just, you know, liberalization can also be done in all sorts of ways.
Sure.
You can just one day say, oh, gates are open, anybody can come in, all regulations out of the window.
That's
right?
Kind of what happened for a little while in certain South American countries.
Yeah, which is what a lot of countries did, right? But that's not what Indians chose to do. There was a gradual liberalization.
Which was actually quite smart now that we think about it.
Yeah. So that certainly you get credit for.
Again, but it was Manmohan Singh, right? Which was my previous
answer. It's not just Manmohan Singh. You also have IMF and all these guys telling you. So, but government always has smart people telling them what to do. The question is, government
usually doesn't listen.
Yeah, what kind of advice do you take, kind of stuff, right? So that is certainly one thing. But at the same time, you also let Babri Masjid happen, right?
Yeah.
And you...
Oh yeah, that was during his time.
Yeah. So you had the most shameful period of communal violence in Indian history during your regime. And from most of the accounts that we have today, it was to a certain extent because Narasimha Rao and all these people allowed it to happen.
Right.
I mean, they could have controlled the situation more easily, but they failed to do it. I would say, so for example, you were talking about a strong leader and all that stuff.
Yeah, I'm just saying that's the common narrative that seems to be
so not
prevalent to any democracy, any populist movement, really.
I wouldn't say a strong leader, but a leader, as in somebody who can actually lead the people and create some kind of...
So an effective leader as opposed to...
No. I'm saying if we talk about the idea of a leader, right? Somebody who people can look up to, who inspires people and stuff like that. We needed that guy in early 90s more than anything but else, right? Because that is the time when Mandal Commission has happened, Rath Yatra has happened, the country is in a lot of trouble, and you really needed somebody who could, not a silent operator who is just doing stuff and shows up on TV every once in a while, but somebody who can make speeches and rouse people up and stuff like that. That we didn't get.
Failure
of what that ended up doing essentially was all these debates, which were really, really potent at this time. The caste debate, the caste question, and the question of religion in this country, both of them kind of got buried under. And neither of them actually, those conversations we did not have in the country. And they still are buried. So we have never had that conversation. The moment to have that conversation, I would say, was early 90s.
Right.
And we just like skipped over that.
Yeah, so it's not so much a bullet, we dodged a cannonball of sorts.
No, we didn't dodge it. If we had had that conversation, maybe we could have reached some kind of a...
Oh, you're saying the fact that it wasn't even discussed is somehow...
Yeah, so because our Prime Minister's policy was... let's close our eyes and just pretend this is not happening,
okay,
right?
Okay.
So, I mean, so that's why you neither have... So, you have issues of caste and religion still in the country.
Of course.
But they are being played out on local levels and state levels, while on central level, they never did. And the moment they could have been done was early 90s.
Mm.
So, that's why it's... Narasimha Rao's legacy is certainly a lot of mixed bag.
Right. But definitely influential.
Yeah, because you can certainly make an argument that while he handled the economic liberalization very well, the economic liberalization itself was forced upon him. Like it wasn't like he had a choice. He was told that boss by the international aid agencies and all this stuff, IMF, that you will have to do it. Otherwise, India goes...
I think the demise of his career really began with the whole Godman thing, right? What was that dude's name? Chandraswamy?
Yeah, I think so.
That's pretty much what ended it for him. Or was the beginning of the end for him?
Politically, it was a long story because, I mean, he was never supposed to come into power.
Well,
true,
yeah. Assassination.
Yeah. But he certainly managed his opposition masterfully. In doing so, he created a lot of collateral damage and too much Harshad Mehta scam, this, that.
God,
also,
I
something.
Forgot all about
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Harshad Mehta. That was a trial by fire, if anything.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, so case made for Narasimha Rao. Let's go on.
Yeah, VP Singh. Because let's skip Chandrasekhar again.
Oh, emotions. Right, VP Singh.
So,
just to reiterate, again, we're talking influential, not good or bad, just guys who had impact.
Yeah, so before Narasimha Rao is Chandrasekhar is again a very short duration. And there are certain things that he does, it's too small a period. To
so really we're not counting him.
Yeah. I mean, so for example, under Chandrasekhar, the Gulf War happened.
I think Gujarat was foreign minister. I remember that one.
All
yeah.
sorts of things. Anyway, so before that is VP Singh. And I think other than anything else, VP Singh's the greatest legacy is obviously reservation and Mandal Commission. And that's pretty much why we are including him in terms of influential prime ministers, because he himself, was... They're too short a time to have like any kind of lasting impact other than Mandal Commission stuff. And Mandal Commission stuff is certainly something that is rushed in within a week, right?
Right?
Like in the last moment, he just brings it out. And it's not a...
Well thought of plan or anything.
No, it's a well thought of plan in terms of there was a commission which recommended all that stuff and all that. But it had been sitting in a government drawer for... a decade, I think, or something like that.
Mm.
And he just pulls it out at the end because of political reasons, right? Because he's being hit. So, I don't know if we have time to get into the...
We can
why.
If you want.
Okay, so the Mandal Commission comes about because within his own party, he is getting hit. Because he is getting hit by Devi Lal, who is the guy who leads these OBCs and other castes in the heartland, right? And he is basically creating trouble for VP Singh. And VP Singh sees that this guy might go out of the government and our government will collapse and we'll have to have another election.
Mm.
So to pull the rug under from Devi Lal and get the support of the guys on which Devi Lal's base is based on, you do Mandal Commission, which is just rushed out. VP Singh's party is Janata Dal.
Yep.
Janata Dal is essentially the spin-off of Janata Dal are Lalu's RJD and JDU and Devegowda and all these guys, right? So they're all part of that.
Mm.
So you pull the rug from under him and you recast Janata Dal as the lower caste party. The moment you do this and Mandal Commission comes in and people start burning themselves and all sorts of this, all this divisiveness, you have a huge other problem, which is BJP is now in a fix, right? BJP is your coalition partner, but BJP doesn't want the caste question to be debated in the country because they want both the castes, right? They don't want to be They want the Hindu vote to be together.
So it's a fractionalization of their...
So they can't take sides for Mandal Commission or against Mandal Commission. To the extent that Alki Advani, he actually gets beaten up by the student protesters. The upper caste student protesters during this time. Yeah, they bash his head and all that stuff.
Oh, wow.
Because they won't take a stance, right?
Right.
So they do the oldest trick in the book when it comes to politics. If you don't like the debate that's happening and if it is lose-lose for you, change the debate. So what they do is, instead of doing the caste thing, they start the Rath Yatra.
Uh-huh.
Rath Yatra is a counter to this. So they are pushed into Rath Yatra because they want to bring out the communal question instead of the caste question.
Oh, that's a very interesting way of looking at this.
Yeah, so then the Rath Yatra comes into picture and then the government collapses, Samastipur and all that stuff happens.
Right.
So when the election comes around, after that, I mean, you have a brief interlude of Chandrasekhar's government. After that, when the election comes around, you have Janata Dal on one side. You have BJP on the other side and you have Congress. And BJP is saying, let's do the Hindutva and all that stuff. And they are far more radical because this is under LK Advani.
Right,
Vajpayee is right now not at the helm, right? So these are LK Advani versus Murali Manohar Joshi within BJP. So this is radical versus radical. That's the leadership of BJP. On the other side, you have Janata Dal, who is saying, you know, we gave Dalits their stuff and lower caste and upper, like OBCs, and this idea of creating this kind of caste coalition, especially when you have super rock stars like, you have political rock stars like Lalu and all these people with you. And then you have Congress under Rajiv Gandhi, who is completely lost because Rajiv Gandhi, they don't want to get into either of
any
the debates.
Other,
yeah,
yes,
right. So they do basically, they come up with this idea of Sadbhavna Yatra and this and that stuff. But they can't really figure out something. And this whole debate is playing out during the elections and then Rajiv Gandhi gets assassinated. And the whole course of Indian history
changes. Yes.
Yeah.
That was a key moment, wasn't it? And that's a good segue too, because now we're going to talk about Rajiv Gandhi.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Happy coincidence.
Not for him, though.
Yeah. So Rajiv Gandhi is certainly, I would argue, and this is going to be extremely controversial, because I would argue that Rajiv Gandhi, other than Nehru, the most interesting prime minister that we had. I mean, unlike Indira Gandhi, if there was any prime minister who I got a sense had a vision for the country, it was Nehru. And after that, Rajiv Gandhi.
Let's back up for a second. How old are you?
I am 30.
So you were barely there when
I was born in 1986. So,
yes.
2 years into Rajiv Gandhi's prime ministership.
So how do you relate to someone like that, man? You know what I mean? You really weren't aware of things within the context of the Indian political system. And that fascinates me, because what do you have to go on apart from historical records, some of which I'm assuming must be extremely biased, because after all, it was the Congress that...
No, but the historical records can be... I mean, that's what primary sources are, right? I mean, you basically reading government documents of the time, but you are also reading newspapers of the time, magazines of the time, the various discussions, political pamphlets, this and that. And you are trying to make a sense of... So, for example, right, demonetization.
Oh, God.
No, I'll give you an example. Demonetization. The sense, what was in the atmosphere during demonetization within India, that will be very difficult for historians. Like, nobody has written down the atmosphere, right? Or the atmosphere that we had during the UPA2 government of scandals and all that stuff. You can have one line saying, government was hit by several scandals and all that stuff, but corruption scandals. But you won't be able to capture the kind of sense and the outrage that people had in 2013 and 2012 in India.
I think we can, man, because we have the internet and YouTube now.
Yeah, so you can to a greater extent, but still, living through it, there is
sure,
no...
Sure, sure,
right? So trying to get that atmosphere again, you do have to rely a lot on the on hundreds of things, from the way stock market changes to way people were talking. And that's why we try to get a sense of not just official documents, but also what generally people were talking about in the water cooler. That's where the social history aspect.
Yeah, but you were not around the water cooler. So.
No, but a lot of the stuff gets recorded inadvertently, right?
A
lot of the stuff gets recorded in the sense that people... So, for example, one of the things that historians do is read personal diaries, not just of political leaders, but just of, like, you know, a 14-year-old girl, right? They will read that to get an atmosphere, like, sense of what people were feeling about whatever that environment was and what the little girl... So, 90% of the little girl's diary would be about right. whatever it is about. But 10% would be capturing that, okay, this is the kind of sense that we get. So all those things get recorded in various ways, and that's one of the trickier parts of historians, of doing history, is trying to like extract it out.
Extract that from.
And hunt it down first, like, because obviously getting hold of documents themselves is very problematic.
Yeah, you explained what it is like to dive into the National Archives and actually look for something.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, that pretty much negates any chance of me being a historian, because screw that. Go on.
So Rajiv Gandhi, right? So that's why I would say that Rajiv Gandhi is certainly a very interesting character, because of this idea that for the first time I felt like somebody who had, other than Nehru, anybody else who had a vision. I mean, most of the prime ministers are essentially doing daily firefighting. They don't have long-term ideas of where the country should go.
Really? You think that?
In what term?
Right. Well, I would imagine that anyone in that position of power would have some sort of long...
Yeah, certainly, certainly. I mean, to some extent. But firefighting comes first, always.
Well, sure,
right?
Sure.
But with Rajiv Gandhi, I felt like he was a guy who had a larger idea in mind than just, you know, getting through the day kind of stuff.
Make your case, basically.
Yeah. So with Rajiv Gandhi, it's interesting, because when he comes to power, he sees a majority that nobody, 400 MPs, right, comes with a majority that nobody has ever seen. And there is this exuberance that he comes in with. The stock market skyrockets in India. And there is a sense that, you know, things are going to change. He brings in this team of, you know, smart, savvy people who carry around, in 1980s, they carry around phones and computers. And there's a constant conversation about making a technology hub and all that stuff. So you have a lot of that stuff going on. And with this exuberance, you do come up with this idea. One of the idea, for example, is about our foreign policy. So we went into Sri Lanka, which becomes problematic afterwards, right? So we intervened in Sri Lanka, we were there, our troops were there, I think around 80,000, something like that. And while you may argue about whether it was good or bad that we were there, right? This is, the first conflict that we had since Nehru's time, which was motivated with more than just immediate gains. We went into 1971 because we didn't want refugees coming in.
True.
But we went into Sri Lanka because we felt a sense of responsibility that as a regional leader, we need to keep people safe. There is a humanitarian component attached to it.
So this was India basically coming to the big boy stage.
Not just in big boy stage in realist terms, but like adding a humanitarian component to it. The idea that, you know, the stability of the region has to be something that India is responsible for. Mm. So that's why you have Maldives in 1988, I think. Maldives has a coup. Immediately, right. India sends its troops restore the thing. So that Operation Cactus is, again, this is something that we didn't have to do. Coup happened in Maldives otherwise. In other times as well, India never cared, right? Here they did care because there's a sense of responsibility. This is something greater than just daily back and forth and transactional value to it. Similarly, in terms of, you know, economics, this idea that we started moving towards liberalization only after, like, suddenly after 90, 91 is not true. I mean, already since Indira Gandhi's second term in early 80s, you are talking about greater liberalization, this and that, and technology investment and all that stuff. And so the movement towards liberalization actually starts gaining momentum in late 80s itself. I might be a little wrong on this, but this is maybe slightly incorrect on this, but there's an interesting story which is about, I think, letting Coca-Cola and all these guys come in back, because we had kicked them out in 70s, so letting them back in. The debate actually was playing out such an interesting level that there were 50 MPs who had signed a letter saying that we must let Coca-Cola and all these companies to come into India because it was part of liberalization. And there were 50 MPs who had said, this is such a bad idea and all that stuff. So you had a kind of, you didn't have a consensus, but you had that debate going on. That's why if you think of any of the major companies today, Infosys, this, that, and all that, they are all brought, like they all are established in the late 80s. That's when these companies actually start coming up. Because there's this idea of movement towards technology, there's this idea of this and that. Which is not to say that his own premiership gets into a lot of trouble, right? I mean, the second half of his premiership is basically just
chaos.
It's just scandal after scandal. The kind of sense that we had in early 2010s.
Towards the end of Manmohan's thing.
Yes. Yeah. It's the same thing. Actually, much worse, like on a greater scale than that. And there's this whole that he himself is implicated in Bofors and all that stuff. Putting that aside, in terms of the way he is thinking about economy and all, and not everything actually comes to a fruition, but there is a thought behind it.
Okay, so in your opinion,
yeah,
he's a guy who could see beyond the immediacy of setting out the fires, putting out the fires, and actually was trying to act on a long-term strategic vision.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly known. I mean, he is not his grandfather, right? He's not like Nehru level visionary.
Oh, we're going to come to that.
Yeah, but he certainly, because we have so few of them.
Yeah, sad fact, but I think you're right on that front. I remember so little of him, though.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to judge.
Yeah.
And it is interesting because it's become it's become very unfashionable to say anything pro-Congress at this point.
Yeah.
Because look at who's at the helm of affairs for them now. It is in many ways, I think it's fair to say, it's not so much that Modi won.
It is Congress that, lost.
Exactly. They went out of their way to make sure that they lost, basically, the Congress.
Yeah.
Because I know more than a few people, long-term Congress supporters who've been voting Congress for good 30, 35 years, regardless of who the candidate was, they took one look at Rahul Gandhi and said, fuck no, no, not him. Like, that's not happening.
Yep.
We have to vote for Modi now because this is just not going to happen. So it is interesting.
No, but anti-Congressism is not something that is new, right? Like,
of course
not. That is, I would argue, most of the elections that Congress has lost historically, they have lost.
Mm-hmm.
Not that the other side
guy won. Yeah.
Right? Like, I would argue that maybe the first NDA would be one of the elections in which BJP won instead of Congress losing. But most of the times, it's Congress's battle to lose.
Yeah.
So, and you have this anti-Congressism running way back in, like, 70s and all that stuff, right?
And with good reason too, for the most part, I'd say.
Yeah, and every time they basically say that, you know, basically say that it's over for Congress now they are done, you know. But these guys come back.
Which is a discussion for another time.
Yeah.
So let's quickly recap who we've discussed. We started with Manmohan Singh. We walked our way back to Vajpayee.
Manmohan Singh, who we kind of like.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it was Vajpayee.
Whose headline was, he could have done so much worse.
Who I just label as Mr. Damage Control.
Yeah.
Then we go back a little bit further and we get to VP Singh.
No, Narasimha Rao.
Oh, correction. Yeah. Narasimha Rao.
And there we say that he's a
mixed bag
kind of
mixed
thing.
Mixed bag.
Yeah.
Then VP Singh.
Yeah.
I still contend very little good with that guy.
Yeah, certainly. But
definitely a lot of influence.
Yeah.
And he did change the course of Indian politics, if not Indian history.
Yeah.
Then comes Rajiv Gandhi.
Yeah, the guy who had the vision but didn't really get anything
right
done.
A vilified and romanticized figure coming up next. And this is going to be a long conversation, I think.
Indira Gandhi?
Yes.
So, yeah.
yes.
Nobody likes Indira Gandhi, do they?
I think the tragedy with her is that I sometimes get a sense that she was thrust into a role which she maybe did not want, but then grew into and definitely wanted towards a later stage.
Yeah, I mean,
right? That's the sense that I get of it. I have not researched her nearly enough to actually say that with any kind of authority, but that's the feeling that I get. And the blemish on her record is such a blemish that it's hard to dodge. And the whole emergency thing was such a cluster that you cannot dismiss that as, oh, an act of whatever.
Yeah.
That was something that was just completely unacceptable, the way she went about it, whether her reasons were justified or not. But she is on the list.
Yeah, I mean, if you talk about influential prime minister,
and I don't deny that.
I do not think that
there's an argument that can be made against that.
Yeah,
definitely.
I mean, maybe Nehru comes close, but I mean, there's nobody who had the kind of impact on Indian history that
right.
lady had. But that's the thing, right? Because Indira Gandhi is complicated. Indira Gandhi is funny. Nobody, like, it's very difficult to defend her. It's extremely difficult to defend her.
The thing that she did wrong, even if it was just the one thing, was so wrong.
It's not just that. It's pretty much... So, liberals don't like her, left doesn't like her, right doesn't like her. Nobody likes her. But at the same time, you have to think that this woman basically ruled Indian politics for better part of, say, like, what? 2 decades or something like that. And, I mean, so how do you end up doing that when you're pretty much hated by everybody?
Mm.
Kind of thing. Or not pretty much hated by everybody, but there's very, very few people today who would argue for her. You can find people who can argue for other leaders, but you can't find one for Indira Gandhi. Then how does it happen? The thing is, I mean, what are the major features of her legacy? I mean, it's not just emergency. It's hollowing out of the democratic institution. The democratic institutions which were built throughout, they are all basically just removed, and all this idea of loyalty and faction and all that. That all basically starts with her. She also brings in this idea of dynasty politics, right?
Yeah.
That, so this is important to remember. She herself came up as an, like, Nehru didn't place her as her, as his successor. So she came up on her own through whatever after Nehru's death. But she clearly placed her successor as her sons, right?
True.
And so that's why you see that the dynasty politics and state parties start coming up in 80s. After she does it, like, she sets the example, and that is when other politicians start putting their sons into picture as well. So it's not a trend in 70s or 60s. It's only a trend in 80s. It comes in about 80s. Other than the democratic
erosion of the system,
Other than that, we have the other aspect, which is about economy, that she basically turns us to socialism. And this whole idea of left and bureaucracy and red tape and blah and blah, all that socialism stuff, that all comes under her. And she nationalizes pretty much all the these PSUs that we today think are these behemoths who are just sitting there and not really producing anything and all that stuff. That all comes under her. So that's also another crucial thing. We have to remember that all of this is... seen from the lens so far removed is easy, but it gets into all sorts of problems. For example, emergency. You know who supported emergency among other people? JD Tata.
Did he not?
Because you have 10% growth or 9% growth, GDP growth in during emergency. People loved it. Like, you know, business guys were like, stuff gets done. Right?
Well, there is that to be said about an authoritarian regime.
So you have that. And while there is critique to be made about putting emergency in, you have to also realize that there was absolutely no reason for her to remove emergency. She did it all on her own. Like, there was no pressure for her to step down. And there are very few instances in history where somebody did something like this and set themselves, set themselves in this way and then stepped down on their own.
You think it was sustainable, though? If she had just decided, you know what, emergency, this is just the way it is now.
Yeah, sure.
You think so?
I don't think that in 77 there was enough groundswell movement to like take her out or something like that. Nobody could have done it at that time.
But eventually it would have happened.
Eventually. Like, who knows what would have happened 10 years later. But by that time, democracy in this country would have been gone to dogs. Like, we would have been another Pakistan.
Yeah.
You have 10 years of dictatorship after that, it's very difficult to go back to election and all that business, right? She certainly could have stretched it out for a few more years.
I think it's still up to debate whether she did it out of her, a sense of self-preservation or for the good of the country. I want to say it's the former rather than the latter.
The argument that her biographers put is because people who were friends of Nehru started criticizing and saying that, you know...
your dad would be so...
So that Jawaharlal Nehru would have been in jail right now had he been around. Because he would be against his daughter. And you have to realize, Indira Gandhi is psychologically an extremely complicated character. With daddy issues, with mommy issues,
that's
all sorts of
things. It's very hard to pass her as a case in point. Like, because there's just so much there that you can plumb through.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a whole thing that, you know, Jawaharlal Nehru, with whom anyway she didn't have a good relationship when she was growing up. Because He was constantly in jail, and at the same time you have her mother, Indira Gandhi's mother, who was ostracized within the family because Nehru's thought that, you know, this lady is from village and she's not as fancy as we are and all that stuff. And then you do reconnect with your father later in life, but your father is disappointed in you.
Yeah, that's gonna sting.
Right?
Yeah.
So the she could never quite measure up to Nehru's standard, and she, like, come on. Indira Gandhi is a woman who, you know, had astrologers and did all that stuff and believed in all this stuff. Nehru is a scientific guy. He would be horrified to have a daughter who, you know, believes in all this mumbo jumbo and all that stuff, which is just an insane
dynamic.
I can't imagine how that
you would think it would be the other way around, as in the dad would be the guy who's more aggressive in many ways.
No,
so,
so
which brings us to daddy now.
Unless,
of course, there is something more you want to say.
No, let's stick with Indira Gandhi and a couple of things. Couple of things that I want to flag are that people should look up, because Indira Gandhi is just too big to, like, cover.
Good place as any to mention any good sources you want to pin.
No. So one of the things is, certainly there's one, the whole interesting thing of Indira Gandhi breaking Congress as a party that
which
happens in the beginning of her prime ministership, and that essentially makes the Congress of today, right, which we all love to hate, with Gandhi family at top and sycophancy and loyalty and faction and all that, and the old Congress, which we read up in the history books with, you know, leaders, several leaders and all these ideas and ideological debates and all that stuff, the transformation of that happens because to keep Indira Gandhi in power, which happens in late 60s, early 70s. And the other interesting thing that happens is that after 77, after she removes the emergency, when she goes out of power, she is written off. Actually, within Congress, she is pretty much sidelined. So other leaders, they take over Congress, and she is basically done for.
Right.
And nobody thinks that she can come back. And the woman comes back, breaks Congress again, takes out the meat, so, and makes a whole new thing. So it was the greatest comeback story of Indian politics, what
true,
she does.
True, that's a very fair point. Yeah.
And then the later stuff, which is that 80s, we have to remember that while in 70s she is all goes socialism and all that stuff, in 80s she is actually moving towards liberalization stuff. Her economic policy is also not a straight
run
towards socialism, but it's complicated in that regard.
Nice. Yeah, she is one person I definitely need to read more on, because it's just, whatever I've read is just so divisive and it's not really well researched. Do you have any good sources you'd like to quote or mention?
So the problem is, with other than Nehru, we don't have any leader for whom we have a good biography, like a really good go-to book. For example, Rajiv Gandhi has no biography at all,
which,
like,
is surprising, isn't
it? Yeah, I mean, they're these silly little booklets kind of thing, but there's no decent, even a decent biography.
We should add a caveat here. What you define as a booklet, most people would struggle to read through.
I mean,
I still have that Ardennes book you gave me, man. That is not easy to read. And I love the subject to death, but even so, it reads, it's very much an academic text. But I mean, fair point. It doesn't detract from your statement that
quality stuff, right? So I'm talking about, even I am keeping in mind popular history, for example,
right?
Even popular history terms, there's nothing decent available on most of these guys. Indira Gandhi has a couple of biographies which are nice, Indra Malhotra and all these guys.
It's a good place to start.
It's a good place to start.
So
yes.
Which ones are these?
So there is, I think Indra Malhotra has a biography. There is,
I'll tell you what, we can discuss this once the show is done.
Yeah.
And I'll add it in the show notes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That'd make a better idea. All right. Now comes the big one.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Say the name.
Jawaharlal Nehru, right?
I knew it. Kangi agent? You are Kangi agent. You have to be. Because if anyone is more fashionably hated, it's hard to think of.
Gandhi? Gandhi is nowadays even hated
This is a contemporary thing, though. Like a very recent thing. Like hate towards Gandhi is fairly new.
Hate toward Nehru is also fairly new.
I don't think so.
No.
Look, this is something that is neither here nor there, because it's a very subjective argument. I, within my circles, the vilification of Nehru has been a very long thing. Just a typical...
No, you're thinking of 80s and 70s. 80s and 90s. I'm talking about like 70s, still 70s. There was no vilification of Nehru.
Ah, see, the time scales are off.
Yeah,
the time scales are off. But yeah,
so, essentially, I mean, because the thing is also big... The vilification in India especially happens not because of some justified fear... arguments. The vilification happens because of the myth that surrounds
it. But dude, he died of syphilis, man.
Yeah, so
he died of syphilis, dude.
Because our sense of history is so weak.
Yeah.
So we have pretty much forgotten all that Nehru was stood for and all that
stuff.
Before
we get into that, where the hell did that myth start from, the whole syphilis thing?
I have no idea. That's just some mumbo jumbo. Yeah, who cares? Like, I don't think people care.
Because there was no WhatsApp then, and I've been hearing this forever.
Yeah. It's just silly stuff. So,
okay.
I mean, there's silly stuff, but even within his own lifetime, he was given to so much of speculation because, you know, I mean, this is a guy who, I mean, you know, had certain amount of rock star appeal to him as well, other than standing above head and shoulders of everybody else in politics
right.
At a time when we didn't have heroes. I mean, the movie stars of the time, 50s and 60s, weren't Shah Rukh Khan or Rajesh Khanna or all these guys, right? Like, they weren't of that size that they... It's around Devanand when this kind of trend starts. So, nobody in 50s and 60s, you don't have people. You don't have heroes and idols. And so, that's why Nehru... All that energy gets channeled into Nehru as well. So, Nehru holds a massive position within the Indian imagination. And which means that there's all sorts of stuff going on about his love life. You know, all the stuff that today we are interested in movie stars, that also gets tacked on to him. Everything gets tacked on to him.
I wonder what it would be like if Nehru had Twitter.
I think he would write the fairly dry tweets.
You think so?
I think he was fairly eloquent, man.
He was eloquent.
Fairly dry tweets as in compared to Trump. Right.
Well, come
as
on.
In,
that guy is a fucking dumpster fire, man. Come on.
No,
let's not even talk about
As in, I'm saying that the Twitter fashion of 140 characters and make it snappy and all that, that's not him.
Yeah, he needs more breath, I think.
Yeah,
fair enough. Fair point. I still think he would do it, though.
Certainly, Nehru looms large over the whole thing. Essentially,
a man casts a very long shadow.
So,
very long shadow.
And this is the thing, right? Like, this is what I... personally think. Countries are like objects in space. So objects in space, you push them in one direction when they start off, like asteroids. So that is pretty much the direction they are going to go 1,000 years later as well. There might be corrections and gravities might pull them here and there and all that stuff, but the initial direction that you threw it in, that is going to matter even 1,000 years into the future. Same way with countries, you know, where you start from, that is where you set the direction.
Very interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
And you have, I mean, later on, later prime ministers can change it, mold it in some way or the other. But that inception point, that's where really the actual history of the country is being written. Right? Like, that's the direction that we are going to go into.
Right, right.
Kind of thing. And that's where you have all the unique aspects of India, which just blow people's mind or fascinate them. All come from here because of Nehru. So we have democracy, stable democracy of the kind. That's certainly because of Nehru. We are secular. That's certainly because of Nehru. Socially, we are not secular. If it was left to the people, we wouldn't have been secular. It was a top-down value forced upon us. Tolerance.
Yeah. We were not ready for it in many
ways.
I think we're still not.
We're still not. Right?
Yeah.
And that was essentially not just that we were made secular, but we were made secular so vehemently that... likes of RSS and Jan Sangh and BJP were kept in bay for like at least 50 years. I mean, it's only now that these people are becoming acceptable. So that Hindu right wing, excluding that, you have pretty much no other country which was which became independent in 20th century which doesn't have a strong right wing party other than India.
Did we always have universal suffrage as well from the get-go?
We had.
We might be exceptions to that.
By that time, I mean, major countries are... So, universal suffrage, and I think France gives in 1945, they give women to right to
vote.
But
they've been an agency for a while.
Right. But that's the interesting thing. Constituent assembly debates.
Right.
There is a debate. It's not a done deal. It's not like we'll have universal suffrage. There are people who say, why do we have to give universal suffrage? We can have other stuff.
Mm.
But here again, you have influence of not just Nehru, other people as well. But the important thing about Nehru, then the why he matters so much and why he is so, is essentially one of the things we have to realize is tremendous amount of coincidence. Because what happens is, Gandhi dies in 1948,
mm.
right? Imagine if you had a Gandhi living alive through 50s. Right?
Oh, I think about that all the time.
No,
I have no idea if it would be a good
no,
thing or a bad thing.
No, because he wouldn't have been part of the government. But he would have had so much political weight.
Of course.
Sitting outside the government. So you have two alternate centers of governance right there.
Right.
And that would have been a political disaster of a highest order, right? You would have two different poles right there. Even if they don't get into, like, it doesn't have to be that Gandhi and Nehru get into a struggle. I'm just saying that somebody sitting outside the government who has the weight to move the country just by his statements, there shouldn't be a person like that or an institution like that. So Gandhi goes away in 1948. Then the only rival that you can have, Patel, he also dies.
Mm.
So again, you don't have any challenge to your leadership.
Right,
so
right.
By 1950-51 is when Nehru is challenged for the last time for Congress presidentship by Tandon. That's the last time when anybody's challenged. Then you have 14 years. When pretty much not just that you are the top leader, but you're not just the first among many, but you are just a whole other category of person.
Right.
And nobody can have any kind of, can do anything to reach your level. There cannot be a second guy equivalent to Nehru within Indian political system. So you have this kind of tremendous power which nobody can challenge.
Yep. Without going dictatorial or...
Yeah, not just that he doesn't go dictatorial, but that means that he has the capacity to shape country in a way that pretty much no other leader would have.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Nobody else gets that kind of an opportunity historically,
right?
Ever in any of the other countries, right?
Especially so close to inception.
Yeah.
As a nation.
Yeah. So that's why you have a guy who is thinking, and this is the interesting part, while having tremendous intelligence, tremendous good intentions and massive influence of this kind and intellectual firepower all to the brim, you still have a legacy which is problematic at best, right? You do fail in several aspects. So for example, economy, that's where he really gets into trouble.
Well, China, man.
Yeah, so foreign policy is this, we will get into that. But economy is certainly something that you get into trouble. While the idea is that there will be rapid development and all that stuff, and there's this idea that we'll create these massive industries and we'll start steel production and whatever, all that stuff. By the time Nehru dies, India is in massive economic chaos.
Mess, yeah. Although that's one of the things that is that acts as fuel to the fire, is that it's easy to say that his economic strategy was terrible, etc., etc. But I can actually see what he was trying to do.
Yeah.
And there's a good case to be made for going socialist during that time.
But
especially given what was happening around the world, it seemed like the Soviets were winning for a very long time.
No, but I think that's also a myth. Nehru was not socialist in the way that...
I'm not saying he was. I'm just saying that it's perceived as such.
Nehru was not socialist in the way that you're thinking, right? Like all the red tapeism and nationalization, that also happens during Indira Gandhi period. So there's a free business, like a lot of idea of capitalism and free market during Nehru's time. There, the idea is not socialism, it's about planned economy. That's the great contribution of Nehru,
yes,
right? It's about the idea that, wait, we are planning that we'll build so many buildings,
mm.
which means we will need so much cement. So that means we better make sure that we have so much cement being developed. That's the... that coordinating all these industries, which on paper looks like not a stupid idea,
right?
And these are smart people with the best of economic thought of the time in 1950s. Like in 1950s, these ideas were not stupid. Or today, planning commissions are out of fashion. But at that time, everybody across the world thought that they were a good idea. Even Americans. Americans supported our first plans. So the second 5-year plan is basically underwritten by Americans.
Huh.
They thought that it was a good idea. They supported us.
What was the key impetus there?
I'm sorry?
The second plan.
Why did
what,
they...
What did it try to push? What did it try to push?
Oh, no. So what happened was the first five-year plan was... I may be a little hazy on this, so people should check, but... The first five-year plan was modest in its expectation. It came out very well. So there was this idea that by going into second plan that we will do more, far more. So the idea was to push more and more industry.
Industry.
And by third plan, which kicks into 1960, there is this huge expectation that we will have a massive plan and this and that. And we will push more and more new industry and do the import substitution stuff and all that ideas. But at the same time, what you were not doing were you were ignoring your agriculture. So by 62, 63, everything starts collapsing because the agriculture goes down the drain and you have food crisis in the country and there's not enough food to eat. So inflation goes through the roof and your plan is collapsed. Mm-hmm. But so by the time third year plan is done, it's already, I mean, people have written off and said that this is all gone to the dogs. And at the same time, you have food crisis of the kind that I think in 64 or 65, cities like Delhi and Madras, they're quarantined because there is not enough food to feed people. The food riots, the food riots all over the place. I read the quarantine thing in the parliament debates of the time. So there's not enough food. So they basically use the term ship to mouth, which basically meant that the food was coming from US and it would reach our ports and immediately go into the market and feed the people because there was no stock, no buffer, nothing.
Holy crap. See, this is fascinating because now obviously my memory is a little hazy on this, but I'm pretty sure in high school, whatever history we were taught within the NCERT book system and CBSE education system, I don't think I've heard a single line about this.
No, but we don't do post-independence history in our coursework, right?
Well,
and this
do.
Is the kind
we
of
do.
Stuff
we, but
yeah.
It's like it's
this
just
is
lip
the kind
service
of,
if
yeah that. And this is the kind of stuff that is not, again, nobody has worked on this economic crisis. It's tragic, but like it's a fairly unstudied aspect. So you have this whole food crisis and that collapses the economy. So the economy is already in trouble by the time he dies. So you have that with these very grand and fairly interesting ideas about Indian economy, they all get into trouble. That's
okay.
Nehru's problem. Okay. Same way with foreign policy. You come up with this very grand idea of
non-alignment
right?
Mm-hmm.
And this a vision not... I mean, again, you have to think about India of 1950s is actually far... has a far bigger global footprint than we have today.
Really?
You know, in 1960, we sent troops to fight in Congo. Because there is a civil war going on in Congo, we intervene.
'60s.
In 1960.
If we were equipped enough
yeah.
to do that,
yeah.
send domestic troops for a foreign war
yeah.
in 1960.
What's the domestic? We send troops.
Troops, sorry.
Yeah,
yeah. And wrong phrase to use there. But if we were in fact that equipped, what the hell went wrong with China?
With China? I mean, China was stronger than us for sure.
Well, it's also
right
there, but...
Yeah. We can get into all the debates over what went wrong with China in terms of, okay, this colonel and that general...
Okay,
no,
let's not get into the specifics of tactical arguments.
But I will give you a broad idea, which is, I think, what Nehru had in mind, which is basically that before 49, you have Kuomintang in China. Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of China. And at that time, you are actually stronger... You have your act together while China has civil war going on.
How can you say
right?
that? That's 1949?
Yeah.
So it's 2 years after independence. We were
yeah.
a mess, man. What do you
no,
mean?
No, but we have our act together in terms of that we are not... There is no civil war going on in India.
Oh, internal politics
wise.
Right?
While in China, there is a civil war going on. You already have gone through a decade-long thing
with
Japan, right? There's all sort of mess. But China is on the same side. China is also pro-West. You are also pro-West. In the beginning,
sort of,
we are also pro-West. The idea is we'll do business with Britain and this and that. We'll have some relationship with Soviet Union, but essentially US and Europe is where we're looking at. So basically, you have a neighbor which is sort of weak and you have, we are on the same side. So it's okay. You can work something out. But what happens is that you have the communists come to power unexpectedly. Nobody in the world saw this. And these guys don't only come to power, they come to power and they double down and they become extremely strong immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They are very powerful. Like,
now that is a fascinating story.
They're able to create a very powerful regime. And at the same time, they're crazy. right? No, I mean, these are the guys who in 1950, 1 year after coming to power, they go to war with the United States.
Yeah, yeah.
Who does that? Especially when United States has nuclear weapon and they don't.
Well,
this
ideologues, that's who.
Yeah, right? So Mao actually is that, okay, fine, you have nuclear weapon, you use your nuclear weapon.
Yeah, because
it's okay.
We are ready to die.
Huh.
Yeah.
Like, we can take it. That's the kind of attitude that you're coming with. And you have this gigantic, powerful, crazy neighbor right on top. What do you do with it? Like, that's a big problem and big question for any leader. Because you can't say that, oh, we will beat China. Because you can't. Like, just because they're bigger.
Yeah.
They're bigger, they're more people, they're more militarized. And you can't have, like, you can't go all crazy yourself in response and say, okay, we will introduce draft in this country and militarize our country. That's not because...
Wait, okay, slight detraction here. Do you think they could have done that if they tried?
No, I mean, you could have a completely different trajectory for this country. You could
sure,
have,
I know
right
that.
From the start, you could have a military-minded person who is like, let's just have a draft and everybody...
That's what I'm trying to say here. This is just me spitballing here. Do you think it would have the Indian public would have taken to it?
I don't know. I mean...
In your opinion?
I don't think so, because even under the Raj, we were not particularly militarized. We don't have a history of being particularly militarized society.
I'm just thinking in terms of so close to inception, right?
Mm-hmm.
So close to independence. Patriotism means something,
yeah.
At least within that time.
But it doesn't mean violent, right? Like, patriotism is
yeah,
not associated
I suppose
with
our,
right?
Yeah, our,
because it's a fundamental
our struggle has been unique that way.
Yeah.
Anyway,
so we were fundamentally different. That is essentially the difference. Most other liberation organizations against colonialism are actually
militant
militaries,
yeah.
Right? They're
yeah.
armies. So all their top leaders are generals and colonels who know how to shoot.
Mm.
They don't think about social development issues and all these ideas, right?
Latijat, Marlowai.
Those are not their top priority. Yeah. While here, the thing that comes to power is a political party.
Mm.
Doesn't even have a military wing.
Yeah, that doesn't get enough
right?
attention, does it?
I don't know. I mean, nobody, I don't know. But like, I can't imagine people like Gandhi or Nehru even had like used a gun ever in their life, right? While you have other countries where the people who are coming to power immediately after independence are people who have probably killed thousands of people. Like,
mm-hmm.
So it's completely different kind of... Anyway, so you have that problem of China, which to a certain extent we have today as well. But today, again, you have powerful... Northern neighbor, but at least he's not crazy. He's interested in making money. You know what he's interested in.
Yeah.
Back then, you don't know.
You just didn't know.
Right?
Mm.
So what do you do? And how do you handle it? So the idea that India comes up, and Nehru comes up with is socialization of China. That what we do is develop relationship with China and basically become a conduit for China to enter the larger international system in which they were completely out, right? Like, they were not part of UN, they didn't have any relationship with, they didn't have embassies of most of the countries, they didn't talk to people. So they are just like this very powerful angry kid on the side of the class who has no friends, right? So because we, our locker is next to them.
He just needed a hug, huh?
No, not just a hug,
just
right?
Kidding,
no,
obviously.
But the idea is that our locker is next to them.
Right.
We have to live, right, with
right,
these guys.
Right.
We can't do anything. They're our lab partner or whatever. So what do? We socialize them into the larger system so that they become responsible. They don't remain crazy like this. They mellow down. And that is the larger thinking with which you go in.
Mm.
And that goes all to hell.
Yeah.
Again, non-alignment. Largely as well is so heavily criticized and is so problematic.
Yeah.
So you have, I mean, despite all this vision, this and that, you get into legacy of economy and foreign policy, which is problematic. But having said that, the political legacy, which is essentially having a secular country with democratic institution, that in that nobody comes close. In comparison.
I think
right?
you're right. I'm with you on this one.
And
yeah.
that is a huge thing because you have a pretty no decolonized country in 20th century. But there are like three countries in the world, decolonized countries, which have like vibrant democracy.
Who are the three?
Like three countries. I can't think
oh,
of it, but I think Israel would be one.
Ooh, that's a different
yeah.
thing though.
Again,
yeah.
right, you can do all sorts of things. But Israel, I mean, what they do in Palestine, what we do in Kashmir.
Right.
So...
Oh man, you're poking people. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. So you have Israel, we have India. I think I can't think of any other country. I'm sure there are a couple of others.
What was Algeria?
I can't think of. But Algeria, I guess.
Post World War II.
Yeah, but this Algeria, I think they become independent in 68 after
so much later.
De Gaulle comes to power, right? But they go through a phase, like multiple phases.
Oh, yeah, there was a bloody phase.
Right?
Yeah.
So, it's messy. Mm. So, you have a lot of stuff like
yeah,
this.
Yeah, I think he doesn't get enough credit now.
Yeah.
That's just sad. And Rahul Gandhi doesn't help at all, strangely enough. So, that is a very strong case that we made for Nehru. And I didn't think you would change my mind on this, but you have.
In terms of
Nehru probably being the defining guy that has guided.
Oh, he's certainly the defining guy, right? Yeah. This is the guy who is essentially.
Because up till now, I have always maintained that it was Gandhi.
Gandhi is, while shapes our independence movement,
yes,
is given pretty much no say in the post-independence stuff, right? Like,
well,
so,
he wasn't alive for much.
No. I would argue that Gandhi is basically told to, you know, like, let's just drop it now.
Mm.
Somewhere around 30s. It's definitely by 40s. He is in charge of the independence movement. He's doing whatever. But he is basically told by other guys, including Nehru, that
we have this now.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to shape the... Because Gandhi's idea is about rural, the Hind Swaraj stuff, based on villages and doing away with army and doing away with industries,
yeah,
and all that stuff. That is not something that these guys want.
Mm.
So, I mean, while Gandhi is a major political force, he is not really shaping the...
Now, how cool would it be to be a fly on the wall for these kind of meetings between him and Nehru?
But we have documents, minutes of a lot of that stuff, and you can.
Who recorded this?
They did it themselves. These guys. I mean, Nehru is one of the most prolific world leader,
right,
bar none in 20th century. He wrote like incessantly.
Mm.
So his notes, his letters, most of these things are available. You can see pretty much his thinking on any issue.
Devil's advocate here, though, wouldn't that be biased towards him if he's the one writing it?
All of the document, like if you write a letter, yes, it's going to buy. What does it mean about bias? It's about. It's not a historical text. It's not like he is
That's
saying
what I mean.
This is the history.
Yeah, this is. You're talking more in terms of like a journal entry, right?
These are his conversation and all that. Yeah, but certainly we would want to cross check them with other things when it comes to contentious issues. But here we are talking about what he thought about things, right?
So you can get insight into the man at least.
Yeah, who better to?
Well, no, that's fine. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying it would have been nice to just see a transcript of the conversation.
Yeah, so a few of those transcripts.
They do exist?
Yeah.
Well, you're going to have to share those with me later.
I think some of that stuff is also in the Congress archives. And Nehru's own documents, other
different
things. But so, Gandhi's documents are also available, right?
Mm.
I mean, they are online actually. Anybody can check them out.
Where do you go to?
Mahatma Gandhi collected works. You can just Google it. You will find it. All of it.
Okay.
So any period, you can just go and see his letters and the way he was talking about things.
And this is all verified stuff.
No, those are his letters. Those are the letters that he actually physically kept. People just like, you know, transcribed them, put them in a computer, made a PDF file out of them.
Okay.
Government of India.
Government of India did this.
Government of
so
India.
So it's a government of India maintained site then.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is, I think this is Gandhi Ashram does this. I'm not sure, but maybe Gandhi Ashram does this. The Gandhi archives are with Gandhi Ashram, I think.
Okay, can you mention the name again?
Collected works of Mahatma Gandhi. Mm-hmm. These are selected works of Nehru are a whole other thing.
Okay.
Which is all the documents of Nehru, which have been all compiled into, I think. They are still publishing it. They are up till 1960, 61, something like that.
Mm.
So I think it's around like 100, 150 volumes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's a huge thing. So... Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, so let's bring this to the close with Modi, right?
Oh man, okay. If you insist.
Given this historical perspective,
yeah.
I think it would be important for listeners to keep one thing in mind, that despite all the emotion that Modi is generating and all that, in terms of like impact on Indian history, he hasn't had much good, or for better or for worse. I mean, it's not like...
He's not really done anything.
Yeah, right? There's nothing much that has been done so far. Demonetization is a minor thing, right? Like, it's not something which will go in the history books as something which will last forever kind of thing. This is a small policy decision. But there's no, like, larger movement in any direction.
But to be fair to the man, it's too early to say anyway.
Yeah, it's, but it's been 3 years, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so 3 years is long enough time for...
Especially now.
Yeah, so this is, I would say... the classic case of daily firefighting,
yeah,
where there is clearly no larger vision.
Right.
There is no clearly no larger idea of how Indians should live, what the Indian economy should take, what direction should it take, how we should behave within the international community. It doesn't seem to be, there doesn't seem to be a major ideas at work.
Well, here, there's no surprise there, honestly.
Right.
Not for me, at least, because I've been tracking the guy even before he was CM, and nothing about him says leader to me.
No, but I would say the other thing, which is that even with the opponents of Modi, so this is something that they can keep in mind, that historically, I mean, when history is written, if Modi is pretty much the entire premiership goes the way the first 3 years have gone, there won't be much to say. It's not like, oh my God, Modi came to power and the world has ended kind of thing. Nothing really happened. Right? I mean, there was creeping communalization and this and that, but they're all minor things.
That should be a t-shirt. I can see it right now. Modi, nothing really happened.
Yeah. So for both the, I think it would be a problematic pill to swallow for both the...
pros and cons sides.
Yeah, the people who really love him and the people who really hate him in long term. Nothing really has...
I can see that.
Changed.
I'm not going to argue that at all.
Yeah. So, which I suppose...
my fear with him, though, is that, like you mentioned about the asteroid in space, right?
Yeah.
Once you push it in a certain direction, it tends to go generally in that direction, barring a few hiccups and course corrections now and then. My fear with him is not that he is going to do anything. I don't think personally he can. He, regardless of what people think, he just doesn't have that kind of power. Yet.
Yeah.
But he's going to set in motion certain things that will make it easier for people that come much later to do things that should happen. That's my fear.
Certainly.
It's like to come, and this is a very, it's an easy argument to make, and it's always an eye roll that happens whenever you mention Nazis, for example, because it's just an easy example to make. With Trump and with him, we just mentioned the word Nazis and people go, oh God, here we go again, the Nazi argument. But the point to be made is Germany didn't wake up one day and see the SS at the door, right? It's not like they woke up one morning, oh, what's happening today? Ah, Nazis! That's never the way it goes, ever. It's the same here, right? It's not going to be jail cells for people who have strong opinions of the against the government. That doesn't happen, but... if you take, for example, just a small thing that's happened now with, say, the national anthem thing, which I wrote about, it's not so much what happens with the anthem today. It is kids who are, say, 12 years old, 15 maybe, walking into a theater going, all right, I guess we're standing up for the anthem now. This is just a quote-unquote normal thing to do. For them, by the time they hit 20, if a new law comes about saying every time there's a car with a blue light on top, you stand to attention and salute that. It's not that much of a jump, right?
Okay.
That also seems fairly normal. Now, I might lose my shit over this, but to them, it's like, well, what's a big deal? And then you take another 10 years on top of that. Now these guys are 30. They are voters, they're taxpayers. They are, in other words, the electorate for the most part.
Yeah.
For them to see a law which comes in, which brings in something like, okay, if you speak against the nation in any way, you are not just censored, but sent to jail. That, again, is not too much of a jump. So you keep doing this over a 50-year timeline, and now suddenly you're in a place where there is no way you could have imagined yourself 50 years ago. That is my fear with him.
Yeah, but... so there are a couple of things, right? One is... certainly, on a minor... So while I was saying that nothing happened kind of thing, I do mean that, yes, on minor level, a lot of things are happening, which I am not too happy about either, right?
Mm.
And we have to keep on, like... battling it out. It's not like we can ignore all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I am saying that let's have a historical perspective in mind.
Sure,
that,
sure.
You know, like, the world is not ending kind
right.
of thing, right? The second thing is when you say stuff like 50 years from now, thing is that the world will change in so many ways and there are so many different directions to go into, right? That you can't say that just because he is creating a precedent, like, Just because Hindu right wing has been growing doesn't mean that it will continue to grow. Things might change in all sorts of ways. So while, as you say, that Nazis... Actually, in some ways, Nazis did show up one day at the door. I mean,
well,
no,
always
as in,
a tipping point, sure.
No, as in that there were other parties which had radically different ideas and they were coming to power. And there was a transaction, right? Like back and forth. It wasn't like that Nazis were steadily growing and there was this creeping fascism throughout the society.
No, but it was definitely an upspike.
Yeah.
No doubt. The
so,
pace at which they took over control is
so
kind of
you have far more than today. You have this authoritarianism of government going on in 1970s under Indira Gandhi, which is a left wing, not right wing, but complete opposite left wing guys. So you had authoritarianism going back then as well. And then it like kind of gets into problem, like the authoritarianism weakens through 80s and 90s kind of thing. Again, there is no guarantee that... While it might be that Hindu right wing keeps going from strength to strength, it might be also that it creates a reaction within the society of a very militant anti-Hindu right wing people,
right?
And they come to power. And they take the country in a completely different direction.
Yeah.
I mean, you see the same with Trump. The guy who preceded Trump was Obama. The poster boy of...
Yeah, hope and change. Was
yeah,
thing,
taller,
yeah.
Like liberal left. And you see after that immediately Trump. So there are these... All sorts of directions that these things can go. Doesn't have to go in one particular
direction. Of course, I'm not saying it will happen. I don't have a crystal ball.
Yeah, yeah,
but that is my fear with this guy.
Yeah.
So, and I don't think it is an illegitimate fear.
No,
it's
certainly
a,
not.
Yeah. So this is what bothers me. Especially.
Let me put it this way: that if I were a Hindu right wing guy who had authoritarian ideas in mind. I am fairly disappointed with Modi's performance. They could have been so much more done to saffronize this country than what these guys are able to actually do.
It wouldn't take right now, though.
Yeah, that's what
that's
I'm saying.
Right.
Like, for whatever reason,
right?
If the argument is that these guys are fascist, which I'm not saying they are, but if that, they're not really good fascists.
Well, they're
right?
Not really
like,
good at anything, really.
Right?
Yeah.
So,
marketing, perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So...
All right. Well, that's a good enough place to end things on. A hopeful note, which I did not see coming at all. I think we did it, man.
Yeah?
Yeah, we did it. We went almost an hour and a half. No tables were upturned.
Yeah, I don't think anybody is going to listen to an hour and a half of
well,
this. But
I
yeah.
don't know. You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. I know of a few people that would take some value out of this. I'm just glad that we did this.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for doing this.
No problem.
And we should do this again.
Yeah.
We'll try to keep it shorter next time.
Yeah.
Or maybe not. Who knows?
Yeah.
So before we leave, is there something you'd like to mention about yourself? You don't have a Twitter handle. I know that.
Yeah.
But
no, but
where can people find you if they want to?
I write here and there, but there is this blog that I run called revisitingindia.com.
Revisitingindia.com. Okay.
Yeah, which has Indian history. For the aim is to have it in a popular mode so that, you know, anybody can read it. You don't have to have a degree to
Excellent.
Get into it.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, sweet. All right. This has been Sandeep Bhardwaj and Bharat Joshi. You can find me on lexvaldez.com where I write about, well, you can see what I write about. And thank you for doing this again, Sandy.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.
Cheers, man.
Bye.
There you have it, folks. India's most influential prime ministers. Hopefully you enjoyed this discussion as much as I did. Given all the drama we are accustomed to seeing on the political stage, it behooves us to take a step back and ask ourselves how much of an impact any perceived action really makes. And for everyone freaking out over Modi, remember, nothing really happened. Yet. This has been the Lex Valdez Show. Until next time, take care. Thank you for listening to the show. If you liked what you heard, do consider subscribing. You can also leave a review on iTunes and share this episode on social media. Speaking of which, you can find me on lexvalidus.com. That's LexValidus.com. And I'm also at lexvalidus on Twitter. Further information, as well as links to any resources mentioned in the episode, can be found in the show notes. Thanks again.